So is it a good year, a bad song, or a bad year and a good song?
When I was 35, it was a very good year.
Trying to have a good year in the middle of a bad year, Obama books himself on conservative talk radio.
I guarantee you, Joe, we are going to get health care reform done.
We'd ride in limousines.
A year of crises, and the president struggles to find the right song, the right metaphor, the right voice.
I think of my life as vintage wine from fine old kegs. From the brim to the dregs, it poured sweet and clear. It was a very good year.
Captain Kirk, President Obama, vintage whining about health care and everything else. It's always a good year on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's August 21st. I'm here with Amy Holmes. Amy, can you tell it's Friday?
I feel like, improving wine.
Oh, it's a very good day whenever Amy Holmes is here. I'm wondering, though, this is a serious point, if the political gridlock on healthcare is due to a kind of massive national crisis fatigue. Yeah, we're having a bad year, but is dwelling on it helping us or hurting us? Joining us now is Theda Scotchpole, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, author of Boomerang, Health Reform and the Turn Against Government. One question here, Theda, is crisis language impeding a constructive debate on healthcare?
A big economic crisis cuts both ways for a major attempt at health care reform. On the one hand, a lot of people are losing their health coverage or are worried about losing it, so it increases the need that people feel for secure access to the system. But on the other hand, it also raises a lot of anxieties about whether the government is doing too much or the right thing to bring about economic recovery and whether we can afford things for the future.
Well, the anxiety level is certainly high. The lesson there is crises never help. Stick with us, Theda. We'll be back with you in a moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the ballots are in for Afghanistan's presidential election, but frontrunners, both of them, are claiming victory. Final results are expected in early September, but already top challenger Abdullah accuses incumbent Hamid Karzai's followers of vote rigging.
More from our partner, the New York Times, on the CIA Blackwater connection. The Times reports today Blackwater employees helped assemble and load missiles on drones used to kill top al-Qaeda leaders. That's work once done by CIA employees, and it's amid reports today of another suspected U.S. drone attack in Pakistan that killed a dozen in the country's northwest. The target was a militant hideout.
In the Atlantic, forecasters say Hurricane Bill's winds are down to about 115 miles per hour. Still Category 3, though, Bill could cause major flooding in Bermuda today. It's not expected to hit the U.S., but could bring stronger waters to the East Coast.
Cash for clunkers is over. Usain Bolt, the Jamaican sprinter, broke another world record, this one in the 200 meters. Wall Street rose about 1% yesterday. The Dow opens at 9350. S&P starts trading at 10.07, and the Nasdaq begins at 1989. We've got Jason Blair on the show later on this hour, talking about a bad year he had back in 2003. Ben Bernanke's going to reflect on a crisis year later today. Do you think there's any sort of commonalities there? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes, here with John Hockenberry. So, John, it's been healthcare all week, all month, really. You might have been able to escape it a little while you were away.
No.
Still broke through. Well, yesterday the president took to conservative radio airwaves with Michael Smirkanish. Take a listen.
Our position hasn't changed. We think that the key is cost control, competition, making sure that people have good quality options. If we're able to achieve that, that's the end that we're seeking.
So, John, I hear buzzwords, but I don't think the ends are at all clear. I don't think Obama's bottom line at all.
I don't think I can remember a sharper contrast between the lack of clarity about what the plan is that we're even discussing and the level of anxiety in this debate about it's a crisis here and a crisis there. Theda was talking about that just a moment ago. It's an amazing contrast to me.
It really is. And to sort it all out, we have Jonathan Cohn, senior editor at The New Republic and author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis. We're also joined by Theda Scotchpole, Harvard professor of government and sociology and author of Boomerang, Health Reform and the Turn Against Government. So, Jonathan, I want to start with you. Can you set the table
there have been these zigs and these zags, to mix our metaphors. Where does the debate stand as of today, Friday, August 21st?
The debate stands. It is not looking terribly good for reformers in the sense that they're on the defensive right now. The president is on the defensive. Democrats pushing this in Congress are on the defensive. They are busy fighting off rumors of death panels, of all kinds of crazy stuff, most of which is frankly not true. But they are on the defensive, and they're having trouble driving the message and getting across to the country what they want to do and putting the focus on what the country needs done.
So what about that government option? This last weekend, you know, we heard Kathleen Sebelius say that it was not essential. Obama said it was just a sliver. And then Robert Gibbs says, no, 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 this is, you know, it's on the table. It's at the center of the plan. So what is it?
Well, you know, in fairness to the administration there, I mean, they are spinning, but sometimes spin happens to be true. If you go back over what they have said the whole time, they have never drawn a line in the sand on this public option. And for people listening, you know, this is the public option is, as it sounds, it's an optional plan that people could enroll in that would be run by the government a little bit like Medicare, but it would be open to anybody who, even the non-elderly.
But basically, and, Jonathan, I mean, it's just another federal program on health care to add to the existing federal programs on health care. I mean, it sounds so draconian, this public option, but in reality, it's just one more in a series of federal interventions in health care, right?
Well, I mean, again, I think the analogy that serves best here is Medicare. It's a version of Medicare for people who aren't over 65. Ask people over 65 what they think of Medicare. They like it a lot. In fact, one of the great ironies of what's going on right now is that somehow the administration is getting blamed for taking health care away from the elderly who have Medicare, when in fact the idea is really to bring the kind of health care that the elderly have, give the benefits of that security, that amount of choice, to everybody.
Well, Jonathan, you might say the irony there is also that he's losing senior support on this. The polling data for him among seniors is not very good. But let me move forward. The New York Times reported this week that the president or White House unnamed officials said that they might be willing to do this without Republican support. But then Obama comes back and says, no, he wants bipartisan support. So, again, can you sort that out for us?
Sure. The answer is I think they are realizing they may have to do it without Republican support, even though they would like to do it with Republican support. I think President Obama himself, I think for reasons both on principle and for political reasons, would like to get some Republicans on board. He doesn't want to do this as a Democratic-only vote. But, you know, when you have the Republican Party out there, their leaders saying that, you know, they want to make this the president's Waterloo, that they want to kill reform, and they're making it very clear they don't want to cooperate, well, you really don't have a choice. And I think the, you know, their Democrats in Congress and the president are saying, well, look, if we have to go this alone, then we will go this alone.
You know, I get so sick of this partisanship thing. I mean, in a sense, we're not a parliamentary system. Okay, fine. So Theda Scotch poll, does partisanship matter at all? Well, who cares if the Democrats do this on their own? I mean, they did get elected, right?
Exactly. I mean, first of all, the Republicans have run off the cliff to the right in this period, and there are not very many of them. And I think, honestly, the question is what Democrats can agree about.
Yeah, right.
And part of the reason the president has been so concerned to let the negotiations play out in the Senate is because he's worried about bringing along conservative Democrats. In the end, they're going to pass something, and it's going to be mainly with Democratic votes because major extensions of Social Security and health care are in the United States are always Democratic initiatives. But the question is how many conservative Democrats will go along with robust reform.
Theda Scotch Poll, you're a professor of political history at Harvard. Can you give us more historical context here? Social Security was passed in a bipartisan manner. Can health care be a durable reform, though, if it's passed along partisan lines? I mean,
well,
I think that's a big question people are asking.
Social Security and Medicare and other major leaps forward were passed in a bipartisan way, and that may be true of the final votes. It was often not true of some crucial votes that shaped the system. They were usually Democrats, and in those eras, they were liberal Republicans, which there aren't anymore.
So Adam McGurney, though, writing for the New York Times, he raised the question that health care reform in this instance, if it's passed along partisan lines, may not be able to be durable. What do you think of that argument?
Oh, I think the key question about health care reform is do they pass something that delivers greater security and choice in health care for regular middle class and working class Americans.
And the test there,
it'll be very popular because all the lies won't come true and the good things will come true. If they pass a bad bill, it'll backfire no matter who voted for it.
Well, the Theda Scotch poll, you set up a perfect point for Jonathan Cohen, and we were talking about this yesterday with Fred Barnes and some of your conservative friends over there, Amy, at the Weekly Standard. And they were saying, and I think, you know, there's some truth to this, that exactly what Theda is saying there sets up the 2012 election, that if they pass something that does provide security, that's an election issue for the Democrats. If they pass something that feels really mushy and bad, it becomes an issue for the Republicans. Is that what this is really all about, Jonathan?
Absolutely, 100%. You know, Washington gets very uptight about how the bill got passed. Is it bipartisan? What's the messaging, et cetera? The country wants health care reform. If they pass a good bill, and if they pass, it won't matter if it was 60 Democrats and zero Republicans, or whether Republicans came on board at the end. If it's a good bill, the Democrats will get rewarded. And by the way, I think that's why they will get a bill. I think at the end of the day, the Democrats understand that if they can deliver a bill, first of all, they'll be credited with a victory. And number two, if it's a good bill, whatever, you know, Sarah Palin is running around saying now won't matter 4 years from now when people realize, hey, I lost my job, but I still have my health care. And I got sick, and guess what? My insurance took care of what I needed.
But Jonathan,
they will be rewarded for that.
Sure, but what about the argument that conservatives do make that 60 million Americans voted for John McCain more than voted for Bill Clinton? And if President Obama uses this fancy reconciliation maneuver in the Senate to basically cut out debate from the other side, I mean, this could be really enraging.
I think that's nonsense. Republicans repeatedly used reconciliation to pass big tax cuts for the rich, and nobody fussed. Americans didn't vote for John McCain over health care, believe me.
Well, let's take the other side then. Is it possible, and Jonathan was sort of sketching this out, that in fact the need to pass any bill and not to have it contain some provision that everyone's going to be mad about, in a sense, pushes Theda to a watered-down bill, a bill that achieves essentially nothing except, hey, we passed something, and now we go to the election with something that isn't too scary. So that is an argument against change. Seems like we net get the status quo.
Well, that's a big danger for the Democrats, because if they pass something watered down, what they're going to pass is something that forces people to buy private insurance at inflated rates. And believe me, that will generate a huge popular backlash.
Jonathan, is there also a risk to the president that this plan will not take effect until after 2010, so Republicans can campaign against the, you know, scary aspects of it for 10 months?
I do worry about that. I mean, in order to keep the price tag down, one of the ways to do that is to delay implementation. And I do actually worry that if they push this off too far, it'll be such a long time before the benefits materialize. They won't see the political benefits. That said, the administration, the Democrats, Congress are aware of this, and there are parts of reform that will be available, that will be material right away, that people will see right away. And I also think that to some extent, you know, people in Washington, you know, people, voters, they will notice, hey, a bill passed. That's good. They will see that as progress.
Yeah, it's all politics, that's for sure. Let me quickly grab you guys with a one-word answer. How many crises do you think we're going through here? We've been sort of talking about that since the top of the hour. Is there a health care crisis? I count three crises at least over the last year. Jonathan, quickly.
Yeah, there's a bunch of crises.
A bunch. Theda, how about you?
Economic, global warming, and healthcare is a major crisis.
Well, all right, that's three. I want to thank both of you for joining us this morning. You are listening to Jonathan Cohn, senior editor at The New Republic and author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis. And we were also talking with Theda Scotchpole, professor of government and sociology at Harvard University and author of Boomerang, Health Reform and the Turn Against Government.
I got this crisis thing on the brain. I mean, Bernanke later today is going to be reflecting on a year of crises. We want you to reflect with us as well. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Give us your reflections. Too many crises.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Let's go out to dinner and see. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
So, Jay, what's the idea there? Popcorn for breakfast, buddy, huh? That's what we're doing. Friday, of course. We're talking about the movies that are debuting this weekend. And do you have that Sinatra clip, Jay? Can you give that to me in just a second here? We've got two film critics with us, Karina Longworth, editor of the movie review blog Spout, and Rafer Guzman. Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday. They're both here in the studio. A couple of interesting movies that are coming out this week. And I guess the general question for you is...
It was a very good year.
Has 2009 been a very good year for movies? And let's begin with the movies that are coming out today. Rafer?
I guess 2009, so far, I haven't seen anything that's really thrilled me. I think there have been some kind of interesting movies that have come out here and there. I think District 9 is actually one of the more interesting films to come out.
Yeah, I missed that last year. Last week I was on vacation. What about you, Karina?
I tend to gravitate towards some of the smaller films, and in terms of indie film, I think it has been a really great year.
A really great year. Okay. Well, let's listen to this. This, of course, is the big Quentin Tarantino rollout today.
Members of the National Socialist Party conquered Europe through murder, torture, intimidation, and terror. And that's exactly what we're going to do to them. We will be cruel to the German. And through our cruelty, they will know who we are.
So, Karina, Quentin Tarantino's kind of belated take on revenge against the Nazis. So you saw this at Cannes. Mm-hmm. Did you love it?
Not at Cannes, but I actually saw it again this week, and it is a slightly different cut than the one that premiered in Cannes, and I think that it works a lot better. Now I love Inglourious Basterds.
You know, this is we got the Brad Pitt who's the wacky Brad Pitt. You know, there's the leading man Brad Pitt, there's the Mr. Cool kind of Ocean's 11 Brad Pitt, and then there's the 12 Monkeys Brad Pitt, the Fight Club Brad Pitt, right?
Right.
Right. And now we've got the burn after reading Brad Pitt, and here Inglourious Basterds is the wacky Brad Pitt. I have to say, I love this persona. Does it work here?
Absolutely. And I think the burn after reading comparison is a really apt one. He's kind of going into hyperactive mode here.
Does he do the bit with the hands like he did in 12 Monkeys? I love that so much.
I don't recall any hand bits, but there are certain times where he just cracks you up with his little twitches.
All right. Well, sounds like a recommendation to me. But here we've also got Rafer Guzman talking about another movie that comes out today. This is Robert Rodriguez, kind of a Quentin Tarantino protege, it's fair to say, wouldn't you say?
Well, they work together. Somewhat.
They work together, yeah. And this movie is short, so let's listen to a clip for a second.
How strong are you guys? I mean, if you really had to be tough against a bully. Because I might have a job for you tomorrow at school.
I was hoping for something a little more menacing.
I will show no mercy.
You're hired.
Kind of a revenge theme, Rafer, also. But it seems to me this is a spin-off in some sense of E.T., in the sense that kids find, in this case, an inanimate object that endows them with special powers, particularly over adults and their parents. Did you like this film?
I did. I liked this film a lot. I thought it was really smart, really, really funny. And I think it has a lot of very sly comments on America's love affair with technology. Mm. The object you're talking about is the wishing rock that grants its holder any wish. But the other item in the movie is the black box, which is sort of a stand-in for the BlackBerry or the iPhone. And it's
set in the suburb of Black Falls,
of
Texas.
Black Falls.
Black
it's,
Box Unlimited Worldwide yes, Industries is
which
where everyone works.
Which, John, is refreshing that it's not set in the suburbs of Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, they've definitely moved away. Well, Rodriguez, you know,
it's
I guess.
Texas, right.
Yeah,
Texas.
So,
right.
I have a question about this with Robert Rodriguez.
Yes.
That he was also the director of Spy Kids, which is, you know, in love with technology. So is this a
right.
kind of a different commentary?
Yeah, it's a very different commentary. I mean, the black box that's in the film is it's a combination of it'll do anything essentially. It's an iPhone. It's a BlackBerry. It's a cheese grater. It's a nose hair trimmer, and it's essentially taking over the world by making everyone dependent on it. And
respond to this, or do you think this is more of an adult message?
I think kids will really respond to it. I mean, it's got enough booger jokes to definitely make it
well,
popular with the younger set.
Really, really good. So the movie there is Shorts. All right, that's out today. And the movie you were talking about, Karina, is Inglourious Basterds. Of course, the posters are everywhere of Brad Pitt. You said, I wanted to get back to that, this has been a great year for independent films. Name some for us.
I really love a film called Two Lovers, starring Gwyneth Paltrow and Joaquin Phoenix.
I loved that movie.
That'll almost definitely be on my top 10 of the year. It's been a really good year for documentaries. films like Food, Inc., and one of my favorite films of the year, Valentino, The Last Emperor, which has been a really surprise hit. I think that there's always interesting things going on in indie film, but due to certain changes in the way films have been distributed.
Distribution is the big story because it's a huge puzzle to find the stuff that's really out there that we could fall in love with.
Can I ask a quick question about Two Lovers? I did love that movie, but did it suffer because of Joaquin Phoenix's strange, was it a breakdown, performance art, rapper, crazy man thing?
You know, honestly, I think probably more people found out about that movie
because of all of that.
Because, I mean, as you say, it is a really hard time for people to even find out that a lot of these films exist.
You know, hey, the indie distribution model now has become the lead star has a gigantic freakout on TMZ. Karina Longworth, editor of the movie review blog Spout.com, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thank you, guys. And now, what are the other top headlines that we're following this morning, Amy?
Well, today we've learned the Justice Department is looking into whether military lawyers for Guantanamo Bay detainees illegally showed clients pictures of CIA interrogators. Groups including the ACLU are working with the uniformed lawyers to defend the detainees. The ACLU says the lawyers have done nothing wrong and calls the investigation misguided. Tom Ridge says he was pressured to raise the terror alert level before the 2004 presidential election. Pretty shocking stuff. In a coming book, the former Homeland Secretary's security chief says he didn't up the level despite pressure from then Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld and Attorney General John Ashcroft.
Although there was a Osama bin Laden tape that was issued right before the election, too.
Yes.
It was a confused, interesting time. I'd love to hear more about that. It's from Tom Ridge's book, right?
Fascinating. A former Bush security advisor, though, says politics never played a role in setting alerts. We'll see who's telling the truth here, I guess.
Right. Yahoo, Microsoft, and Amazon are teaming up to fight Google in something that could be a movie plot of its own. They're all united in opposing a legal settlement giving Google digital rights to millions of books. Google says the companies are just trying to stifle competition. Some California lawmakers want to block a plan to take thousands of inmates out of prison and put them under house arrest. The plan is part of a larger effort to save $1.2 billion on corrections spending in the state. It has passed the Senate, and as you recall, there's like $26 billion of debt there in the state of California, so they're in trouble.
Those are some of the top stories we're following today. Coming up, both leading contenders in Afghanistan claim victory in the presidential election. We'll find out all the details next.
Can't both win.
No, you can't get over 100%, I suppose.
A tie in Afghanistan. I don't think so.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Amy Holmes. I'm here with the inestimable John Hockenberry.
Well, thank you for that.
The big news from Afghanistan this morning is incumbent Hamid Karzai and ex-Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah are both saying that they have won an outright majority in the country's presidential elections.
And that's at odds with the reporting we've done really for the last couple of weeks, which suggests that they both conceded that there would be a runoff. So under an outright majority, but we don't know yet.
So we're learning more. The ballot counting is finished. Government officials say they will have a final result on September 3rd. Joining us to discuss the election is Brian Katulis, an election observer with Democracy International. Welcome, Brian. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me on the program.
So set the mood for us right now. What are you seeing on the streets of Kabul?
Well, on the streets of Kabul, it's actually a bit more lively today than it was yesterday. Yesterday was a bit of a ghost town because of checkpoints and restrictions on vehicle movement to address the security concerns. It seems that people did show up to vote in Kabul, more so perhaps than in other parts of the country. But today is, you know, it's quiet. It's a Friday. It's the day before, I think, Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan starts. And as far as the elections go, it's a very mixed and murky picture because we're only getting partial information. We're getting the two candidates, as you mentioned, in the lead-in, spinning people in terms of they won, and much like we see people in the spin room after a debate in our country.
Right.
And it's just way too early to tell.
So, Brian, how are Afghans reacting to these claims? Are they, you know, sort of watching intently? Are they getting into arguments? What are you seeing?
Well, I think today, and this is just my own subjective interpretation, is that perhaps many Afghans are just moving beyond and not paying too much attention to the spin, and they're anxious to see the results. The Independent Election Commission, the Afghan-led body that actually manages the election process, just had a press conference here about an hour ago here in Kabul. And they said that they finished counting the presidential ballots around the country, but they don't yet have a count. They'll have a preliminary result Monday morning is what we're hearing. So I think – and this is just my own interpretation. I think many Afghans were they're waiting to see official information and not listening terribly too closely to the different spin from the different candidates.
You know, what we were hearing in the lead-up to this election, Brian, is that there were vast differences province to province, whether the turnout was high or low. The Taliban had enormous impact in certain places, perhaps almost none in areas like Mazar-e-Sharif. Does the count or even preliminary suggestions of the count reflect that at all?
Well, what we're hearing from our observers, and I can speak, most clearly to that, is that it's a very mixed picture, as I said at the outset. I mean, on the positive side, the process did go forward in many parts of the country in the face of violence and some vicious threats from the Taliban. On the negative side, it does seem like a significant number of voters were disenfranchised by this violence and the threats. We had an observer team in Ghazni, which is only about an hour and a half outside of the capital, and they were, in essence, in a combat zone. I mean, they were unable to go out and about, and it seems that some people were just not able to vote in some parts of that province because this is a war. I mean, and it's a remarkable thing to try to hold an election in a war. And it's I think, very important to help people understand that context, that this did go forward, but it seems that large numbers to be lower.
Let me push back on that a little bit here, just briefly, because, I mean, there's a clear political interest in the Obama administration saying, hey, we held the election no matter what. And election monitors, right, I think, are certainly accustomed to observing corrupt practices, and we had reports of those leading up to this election. But what's the threshold in a combat zone situation where, I'm sorry, you have to say, look, this is not a legitimate election because too many people were disenfranchised because of the security situation, and Obama can't claim, hey, the heroic people voted, because we really don't have the numbers to support it.
Well, I'd say two things to that. I mean, first, in terms of legitimacy, ultimately it will be the Afghan people that will have to determine that. We, as independent, international observers, our primary goal is to offer some recommendations on how to improve the mechanics. So a lot of the questions of legitimacy are a bit beyond our brief and actually will need to be determined by the Afghan people. And then second, going to the policy question, I do believe, and this is my own view, that there really is a serious question of if the leaders that emerge from this election are seen by the Afghan people of not having the legitimacy that they need, it calls into serious question some of the Obama administration's goals of advancing governance and economic development here. And that's just, my own view as an analyst. I think it creates serious challenges, but we're way too early in this process. The votes are still being tabulated, and we need to see how the Afghan people react.
So, Brian, getting back to the question of violence, leading into the election, we heard the Taliban threatening to cut off the fingers of people who voted, that the blue ink, of course, would be the giveaway. Has there been any kind of retribution?
As yet, we've not heard that, but there's actually a young man in the studio here with us who actually voted yesterday, and he mentioned to us he's reluctant to go back to his home province until the ink fades from his finger.
No, I had read.
So it's.
Wow.
Sorry, I had read, though, that the government was going to set up special chemicals so that people could wash off that blue ink very quickly. That hasn't happened.
It actually has happened. The ink was washed off by one of the presidential candidates yesterday, Barsha Dost, who was, third or fourth coming in at the polls. And he was trying to make the point that this, look, the ink you can get off very easily here. And this means that people could vote two times or three times. So
unbelievable,
it's something
detail,
that, that American voters could not possibly relate to it.
Around the world, you've got Australians where it's illegal not to vote. OK, in the United States, if you didn't vote, you're viewed as kind of like a loser. And it's a matter of life or death in Afghanistan, Brian. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for some people, it really is. And I think I was struck, and this is just my own view, when I went out to the polls here in Kabul. At one polling center, it was actually quite crowded, and they actually allowed me into a women's polling center because they're segregated by gender here. And the mood was quite festive and, in fact, maybe even defiant, because I asked some of the voters, well, did you fear coming out? And they said, no, absolutely not. And we want to express our voice in the ballot box. And I went to another polling station, and it was a, was a ghost town, and this was just 2 or 3 kilometers away. So I think it varied quite a lot, and it was a tale of many different elections out here. And frankly, this early in the process, it's hard for us as independent observers to call, you know, I don't think there's an easy, simple line just yet. We're hearing, you know, from the Obama administration it's a success, but they have an interest in doing so. We have a different job.
Well, Brian, I want to thank you for your job and your bravery to be out there observing these elections. That was Brian Katulis, election monitor with Democracy International. And also, Brian, please tell that young man in your studio that we honor his courage as well. John,
definitely
the headlines?
A great picture. Yes, in the headlines, a popular Cash for Clunkers rebate program we've been talking about this morning will come to an end on Monday night. White House is winding it down as the money runs out. New information on the CIA Blackwater story from our partner, the New York Times. The company has helped build and load missiles on unnamed Predator planes that strike al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And John, those drone attacks continue. A dozen are dead after an apparent missile attack from a U.S. drone in Pakistan. The attack targeted a top militant commander's compound. Hurricane Bill has Bermuda on alert. The Category 3 storm now has winds near 115 miles an hour. It's not expected to hit the U.S., but it can still bring dangerous waves and riptides to the East Coast.
President Obama might catch some of those riptides this weekend. The first family plans to spend a week at Martha's Vineyard. Ramadan begins around the world. Muslim worshipers will fast for a month, and those are some of the top stories we're following today. Still ahead on The Takeaway, talk about having a bad year. Jason Blair, formerly of The New York Times, is now a life coach, coaching other people with bad years. We'll hear about it.
Good morning. You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Amy, there is nothing fantasy about $800 million, right?
No, that's quite a pile of cash.
No, and that is the amount of money that the fantasy sports industry generates annually. Joining
real
us
money,
now,
not
real
fantasy money.
Absolutely. And to preserve those assets, even though the entire fantasy sports issue is a kind of a virtual world, okay? Money is real. The world is virtual. You actually need insurance. Here to talk about insurance products for fantasy sports characters, people like Hideki Matsui and Derek Jeter on fantasy baseball teams and, you know, fantasy football teams the same, is Anthony Giacconi, president of Intermarket Insurance Agency, the co-inventor of fantasy sports insurance. He joins us from Huntington, New York. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning, John.
And Paul Charchian, president of the Fantasy Sports Trade Association and host of Fantasy Football Weekly, a radio show on KFAN in the Twin Cities. Paul, good morning to you.
Hi, John.
So, Anthony, why do you need insurance on your fantasy baseball team? I thought this was more of a hobby.
Well, it as you had indicated, it is real money that's put on to develop these teams by the individual team owners. And perhaps the best way I could answer that question is to tell you how the fantasysportsinsurance.com came to be. Henry Olszewski, a sales executive at our agency, Intermarket, was a team owner last year. He had a fantasy football team within a league, and he had drafted Tom Brady as his quarterback, and he was feeling pretty good about his chances of winning the league because Tom is a prolific point getter, and anyone who had him had the opportunity to score a lot of points and over the season win their league.
But then?
Then the first quarter of the first game of the season, Tom Brady was injured and did not play another minute for the rest of the season.
So you need insurance to protect against other players having that problem. What does it cost to insure the fantasy Tom Brady versus what you know, the Patriots possibly insure the real Tom Brady?
Well, this is real insurance. So what we are offering is coverage for the team owners, the fantasy team owners' investment in their team. Usually it costs to join a platform to or your league, and there are statistical data fees from magazines and websites that give fantasy sports data.
Right. Are we talking $5, $10, $100?
Well, it's about $10 for every $100 of insured.
Okay, Paul Charchian, what kind of a revenue stream is this? So we're running out of time here, but I love this subject.
Well, it really depends on whether or not this catches on. It's probably not something everybody's going to go for, but for those people that feel like they've got enough of a financial investment in their league and they want to back it up with some insurance, sure, there's some prospect of some success here. But, you know, at the same time, fantasy players are kind of you know, there are people that like a little bit of risk and a little bit of danger, and they like the competition.
Okay,
so
let me hit you with one, Paul. Would you pay for an insurance policy for the injury-prone Jose Reyes, who plays for the Mets?
You know, see, I personally, no. I don't think I would, because that's part of the game, and I don't have a problem with that. That said, there are other people that will.
Anthony Giacconi, how much would you charge for an insurance policy? About $500? Maybe a couple thousand?
No, for every player that's eligible, the rate is a 10% rate.
All right.
And, you know, great if you had stuff. Tom Brady, you'd have a different perspective, and NFL team owners.
Got it, got it. Anthony Giacconi, president of Intermarket Insurance Agency, and Paul Charchi, and president of the Fantasy Sports Trade Association. Real insurance for fantasy players on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up, we're joined by Jason Blair, once a journalist, then a very much fallen from grace journalist, now a life coach. We hear his new take on recovering from a very bad year. Up next, first, let's take a look at some of the top stories we're following today, Amy.
The Justice Department is investigating three military defense lawyers representing Guantanamo Bay detainees. In question is whether they illegally showed photos of CIA interrogators to their clients. Groups working with the uniformed lawyers say they've done nothing wrong. Afghanistan's presidential votes are in and counted, but both top candidates are claiming victory. Official results are not expected until early September. There are a number of accusations and reports flying around of polling irregularities.
And there's the question, the overall question of the turnout, which could be actually the biggest story of all. We've already reported that on this program. The World Health Organization wants countries to pick up the pace and get ready for another spike in H1N1 or the swine flu. The WHO expects an explosion of cases soon.
It's the final countdown for Cash for Clunkers rebates. The program is ending Monday night as money dries up. That's as car dealers complain they're not getting paid back by the government fast enough. Cars and oil both on the rebound. Oil hit a year high in trading this morning, breaking $73 a barrel. And sprinter Usain Bolt has done it again. He broke another world record, this time in the 200 meters. Here's his interview after the race.
Who is Usain Bolt?
It's them, right here. I'm Usain Bolt, the only one. There can only be one.
Shades of Muhammad Ali, don't you think?
He can say whatever he wants.
He can say whatever
Fastest
he wants.
Fastest man in the world.
That's just the latest world record Bolt has shattered, and those are some of the top stories we're following today.
It was a very good year.
2003. Remember back to 2003. Jason Blair, life coach, joining us from Centerville, Virginia. Some people will probably remember your name, but remind us, 2003 was not a great year for you, right?
No, it wasn't.
You were working for the New York Times, right?
I was working for the Times, and in 2003, you know, unbeknownst to me, I had I had been going through all sorts of different things, didn't understand them, didn't realize I had a mental illness, but I had plagiarized and fabricated stories, had gotten caught, ended up in a psychiatric hospital, resigned from the paper under pressure. There was unbelievable turmoil.
Right. Well, you know, it was called the Jason Blair scandal by people at the Times the worst, the lowest point in the 152-year history of the paper. I'm wondering, Jason Blair, if today the New York Times, struggling for its financial life in some sense, would yearn to have the problems it had back in 2003. There's a bit of timing here, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, the year 2003 to 2009 have been pretty tough for the Times. You know, I don't think they'd ever want to go back to something like that.
And we wouldn't want to go back there, no.
No, as bad as the business problems are, their journalism, you know, is what they value the most. And I think that was a particularly hard time for them. And, you know, I acutely feel that as somebody who cares about the newspaper.
All right, so you got in trouble for writing fiction for the nonfiction New York Times. Now you're doing something very different as a life coach in Virginia. How do you acquire the credibility to advise people on crises in their life if you have a reputation for pushing the truth a little bit?
Well, I didn't intend to, work in a professional field helping people. The way it actually started was I started some support groups in Northern Virginia for people who had bipolar, you know, not necessarily because I wanted to help the world, but because I needed a support group to go to relate to people. And I spent about 3 years leading those support groups. They grew. There are numerous ones for, you know, there's one for teenagers. There's two for family and friends. a number of ones for people with bipolar and then people with depression. And in the course of that, I came across Dr. Michael Oberschneider, who's the director of Ashburn Psychological Services, a well-known and respected private mental health practice.
Who actually joins us now. He's on the line. Dr. Michael Oberschneider is the founder and director of the Ashburn Group that Jason Blair is now employed by. What attracted you to, I would have to say, a difficult property, Mr. Jason Blair, and when you were looking at his work in these support groups, Dr. Oberschneider?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show, John. Well, let me first start by saying I wouldn't have hired Jason Blair when he was actively bipolar or substance abusing. I hired Jason Blair in recovery, and we know in our field that there are a self-select group of people who enter our field through the back door. Those who have had mental illness or substance abuse turn their lives around and then can make great contributions to the field. I mean, some of the best substance abuse counselors I've ever known are previous abusers themselves. Even some of the greatest theorists of the field, Marsha Linehan, for example, is outspoken very much about her own borderline personality disorder. Her contributions to mental health are invaluable. I'd put Jason Blair in that group. He's smart as a whip. He's got an electric personality, and he's highly trained to do life coaching. He's helping us as a team tremendously. He's an invaluable asset to Ashburn Psych.
Jason, this is Amy Holmes here.
Hey, Amy.
I have a question, though, that I really want to clarify. So mm-hmm. You say you've been diagnosed as bipolar and you had
Correct.
Substance abuse problems while you went through your career crisis at the time. Times, are you then attributing your journalistic lapses to bipolar?
No. I've long said since then, and it's one of the points that gets obscured in the whole story, that the role that bipolar disorder played in what happened at the Times is it magnified it. It made it out of control. It made it very hard for me to reach out for help. But ultimately, the key to, when you look at my story, the key to, being treated for bipolar disorder, it added to my quality of life, but it then allowed me to explore some of those character issues and some of those other problems that also contributed to it.
So how do you recover? I mean, I can see how you recover clinically and medically from bipolar. I mean, I've never had the experience, but I understand there's a trajectory there that's clinical,
right.
And the doctor could talk about that. But how do you recover your reputation personally, your credibility?
I don't think it's been necessarily a mission to recover my reputation. It's just happened on its own by the hard work. Working in the support groups and working with people in the mental health community, and they see the blood, sweat, and tears. They see the effort. They see my willingness to show up at 3 a.m. at the hospitals to learn, to understand. I think that it has, how can I put it this way? For a lot of people who are in mental health recovery, it's very appealing to them to see someone who has fallen so far and then to see that
right.
person in front of their face rebuilt. So
Jason, I don't mean to be cruel here, but would you say that you've recovered your reputation professionally in terms of journalistically, or that you've just created a new reputation?
No, I mean it's a new reputation. It's not about recovering. For me, it's not about recovering the journalistic reputation. One of the questions that I've gotten over the last few days has been, hey Jason, how do you react when people say X, Y, Y or Z, or you shouldn't be doing this or that? For the most part, I never get that reaction. What people see is what I'm doing in their loved one's life, in their life. And the relevance of what's happened in the past for them is how it can inform or help their individual situation.
And how many subscribers to the Times are there in Centerville, Virginia? We got to go, but I have to ask you. So if you were given a speech like Ben Bernanke is today, reflections on a year of crisis, how would you reflect on a year of crisis in your deep experience, Jason Blair?
You mean in my own life?
Yeah, your own. I mean, crisis is a crisis, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the one thing that I can say about crisis, which doesn't exactly answer your question, is don't make the mistake I did and not reach out for help. Because if I had reached out to the kind of people who have helped me since I left the Times, before, we probably would have never been in that situation.
Well, takeaway there from Jason Blair. His crisis year was 2003. Dr. Michael Oberschneider, yeah. Is there any potential here? Maybe you could get Rumsfeld involved in your support groups. There's no bipolar issue there, but he needs some rehab.
Yeah.
He needs some rehab.
I'll take no comment on that one.
Shout out to
yeah. Jason. He's a fantastic life coach, and he's really an important member to the team. I wish every mental health practice had a Jason Blair on their team.
Well, very smart man there, Dr. Michael Oberschneider. Thanks for being with us. Founder and director at Ashburn Psychological Services. Also, Jason Blair, the Jason Blair scandal creator there at the New York Times, now a life coach in Centerville, Virginia.
Fed Chair Ben Bernanke is reflecting today on the year in crisis. We hope maybe in rhyme. It was a year ago that the financial market began to fall apart just in front of our eyes.
Take Jason's advice, Ben. Reach out to people who can help you.
Yes.
Timothy Geithner, he can help.
We want to hear about you. What caused your year in crisis, and how did you get through it? And if you were a banker, you tried to convince the country that you deserved the funding. Take a listen.
I know that the TARP funding decision was difficult for Congress. But I intend to make sure that when it comes to the city, you will look back on it and know that it was the right decision for the nation and also for the American taxpayers.
Oh, poor guy. He had to take billions of dollars from the federal treasury. That must have been hard for him.
Oh, it must have been difficult. That was Vikram Pandit, chief executive of Citibank. No telling yet if he's out of his crisis.
We're praying for you, Vikram.
Tell us how you got into your crisis, how you got around it, how you got over it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you missed anything, we're always on thetakeaway.org. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now.
I wonder what Vikram's speech at Jackson Hole would be. Maybe he'd follow Bernanke. Reflections on my own personal crisis.
Perhaps they're sitting in a circle even.
Om kumbaya, everybody. It's Friday. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Amy Holmes. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
What happened to my Honda?
I'm sorry, baby. I had to crash that Honda. Will you come on now, please?
Whose motorcycle is this?
It's a chopper, baby.
Whose chopper is this?
Zed's.
Who's Zed?
Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead.
Pulp Fiction, blunt fact. Zed's as dead as Cash for Clunkers. The popular program hit the pavement last night in a bad way, but we're still cruising, baby, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, August 21st. I'm Amy Holmes here with John Hockenberry.
She's sitting on the chopper, folks. Good morning, Amy. Coming up, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke reflects on the year. Wonder what pearls of wisdom he'll offer later today in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And former New York Giant Plaxico Burress, he's not having a good year, going to jail on gun charges. 2 years in prison, is that the right call? And we'll talk to Lawrence Bender, producer of the new film Inglourious Basterds and most of Quentin Tarantino's other films. Lawrence Bender and more coming up this hour. Sounds like a great day.
But first, we're going to be talking to Brian Willen. He is the sales manager at Albany Honda in Albany, Georgia. Brian, how many cars does the government owe you checks for?
They owe us for 29 out of 30 clunkers.
Ooh, and what does that add up to?
It's a little more than $100,000.
So they say the check is in the mail. Do you think you're going to see it?
I think we will. I think that we'll get the funds. It's just a question of, you know, how long it takes.
And hang on with us. We want to talk more with you, Brian Willen. But first, we're going to be looking at the headlines.
So is it cash for clunkers or no cash for suckers there? Poor Brian. We'll talk to him in a minute. In the headlines, the result in Afghanistan's presidential election isn't out for a couple of weeks. But two front runners aren't letting that stop them from claiming victory. Top challenger Abdullah Abdullah and incumbent Hamid Karzai both say they're ahead, this amid numerous accusations of voting fraud. More from our partner, the New York Times, on the CIA Blackwater connection. The Times reports Blackwater employees have helped assemble and load missiles on drones used to kill top al-Qaeda leaders. That's work once done by CIA employees alone.
The drone attacks continue. A dozen are dead following an apparent U.S. missile strike in northwest Pakistan.
The target was a militant commander's hideout. Forecasters say Hurricane Bill's winds are now at 115 miles an hour. The Category 3 storm is set to cause major flooding in Bermuda. It's not on course, however, to whack the United States, but it should churn up strong waves on the East Coast. That could put a damper on President Obama's Martha's Vineyards vacation plan. The first family leaves this weekend for the week-long trip.
Tom Ridge causing headlines. He says he was pressured by the Bush administration to raise the terror alert level before the 2004 election. He makes the claim in a new book. Former White House security advisor said politics played no role in those alerts. Yahoo, Microsoft, and Amazon are teaming up to fight Google. They're all united in opposing a legal settlement that will give Google digital rights to millions of books. The Google company says the companies are just trying to stifle competition. And in sports, a new world record in the 200 meters. Usain Bolt has done it again. He broke his record at the Berlin World Track and Field Championships. Oil hit a year high in trading this morning, breaking $73 a barrel. Wall Street rose about 1% yesterday. The Dow opens today at 93.50. The S&P starts at 10.07. The NASDAQ begins at 19.89. Futures trading suggests a flat to positive opening. So reflect on a year of crisis. Ben Bernanke is going to do it later with economy. We're going to talk about that on the show, but we want to hear your reflections on a year of crisis at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm Amy Holmes here with John Hockenberry. So, John, cash for clunkers is going to the junkyard in the sky.
The junkyard in the sky.
The junkyard in the sky.
Junkyard in the sky.
The Department of Transportation announced yesterday that on Monday, the program will be over. It will be kaput. So set your clocks. That's 8 p.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. West Coast time. Was the government a victim of its own success?
This is actually a high-class problem to have, that we're selling too many cars too quickly, and there's some backlog in the application process. It is getting fixed.
Clunkers is a high-class problem?
It's not a clunker junkyard in the sky. It's actually the junkyard in your driveway because you want people to unload the clunker anymore.
On your front lawn. Yeah. Joining us to discuss it is Micheline Maynard from the New York Times. Micheline, you've been covering this story. Tell us what happened.
Well, what happened, Amy, was that the program was, I guess, kind of a victim of its own success. And actually, you could argue it was underfunded because the original request to Congress was for about $4 billion for the program. It only forked over about $1 billion. And then when the cash ran out so fast a couple weeks ago, it had to restock the fund with about $2 billion. And that money has just about disappeared. There has been so much demand so quickly for these new cars.
So could you say, though, then that the government misread the level of demand here?
You know, we've been talking about cash for clunkers throughout the spring. You know, when they were doing the bailout for the Detroit automakers, it was going hand in hand with cash for clunkers. And so some dealers, I didn't realize this until I looked back on it, but some dealers started to promote the program a month before the program officially started. And so when the doors opened at the Transportation Department to start processing the applications, they were already flooded with applications. That was one of the problems. There just weren't enough people to process the applications.
Well, it's an amazing commentary on the auto industry economy. And your book that's coming out in October, The Selling of the American Economy, I wonder if you're going to have to rewrite a chapter on this. I mean, when we were talking about all these crises that were in the auto industry, I don't think we had any idea that cash for clunkers would be such a huge story at this point in the year.
Well, it's a huge story, but it could end up being a footnote for the industry, because when you look at the actual demand that's coming out from this, it's kind of a bubble for the summer. And I think what people are worried about is that when we go to the fall and we don't have cash for clunkers and we don't have all those ads, that people will just go, okay, I guess I don't need a car. I mean, you have to remember, a lot of the folks turning in their cars have been driving them into the ground, literally. These are cars that are 10 years old, some of them. They didn't get very good fuel economy. If somebody is going to give you $4,500 plus the rebate that you can get, you're going to go and check that out. And in a lot of cases, they're trading in clunkers, they're trading in low fuel economy vehicles and coming out with something much more fuel efficient.
Well, Mickey, we have someone here who is handing out that money. Brian Willen, you are a Honda dealer in Georgia, and there was so much demand at your dealership that you had to put the kibosh on it. Is that right?
Well, we kind of pulled the plug on it just to wait till some of this funding starts coming in and ensure that we're able to
you know, get the receivables we already have on the books taken care of.
So the president, he's putting the spin that this is a high-class problem. How do you see it? Is it just more of a cash flow problem?
I think it's not so much a cash flow problem. The money is there. It's just a red tape paperwork problem right now and getting the applications for the rebates processed. I think they they understaffed the center there where they're processing these applications.
Well,
so they have a backlog.
That's pretty annoying. I've got to ask you before we go, Brian, what is the like ultimate clunker based on your experience? I mean, what is the dirtbag car?
That's the worst car that's rolled in.
Oh, yeah. My Lord. That's a real distinguished list, but I'd say the honors has to go to we took in a 1989 Chevy truck that I don't know how it got to the dealership because it does have to be in running condition to qualify for this program, but it was a piece of work.
That's funny. So, Mickey, given the popularity of this program and how easy it is for Washington politicians to score political points for it or with it, are we going to see a sequel, Part 3, Return of the Clunkers?
I don't think we will, for a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, there's a lot of money that needs to be spent on a lot of other programs. And you have to remember that now Cash for Clunkers will be a big deal over this weekend. But during this past week, the demand for it had started to fall off. It was very popular at the beginning. It'll be very popular at the end. But, you know, like all rebate programs, the longer you offer it, the less people seem to be interested in it.
Well, Micheline, I want to thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to Micheline Maynard of the New York Times. She was joining us from Ann Arbor. She has a book coming out in October called The Selling of the American Economy. We were also talking with Brian Willen. He is a sales manager in Albany, Georgia, at a Honda dealership. Thank you both.
Thank you.
When I was 35, it was a very good year.
Well, Jesse Eisinger, I don't know how old you are, but you kind of had a rough year over this last 12 months, wouldn't you say?
I did, slightly over 35.
Yes, but, former Wall Street editor for Condé Nast Portfolio, which folded just a few months ago, joins us now to reflect on Ben Bernanke's speech in Jackson Hole later today, reflecting on his not-so-very-good year, reflections on a year of crisis. First of all, you know, does the title annoy you, given your own personal economic experience over the last 12 months?
Well, you know, you don't want the Fed chairman to give the mission accomplished speech, of course, you know, aboard the aircraft carrier. But I think Bernanke's too smart for that and too cautious. So we'll see. It'll be an interesting speech.
Is it a little bit early to be reflecting on the crisis? I mean, if we can make the comparison to 1929-32, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 90% over a three-year period. And there were plenty of conferences of economists in well-heeled locations where people were saying it was over as you know, early as 1930, and things got much worse from there.
Yeah, it's absolutely too early, and there's no greater example than that than Bernanke's speech last year at the Jackson Hole conference, which really sort of took a next step of talking about regulatory reform in the aftermath of Bear Stearns's failure and selling to J.P. Morgan. And, of course, then we got the disastrous September, Lehman Brothers failing, AIG having to get bailed out, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley converted to bank holding companies. So it's way too early. The big challenge is coming up for Bernanke, which is to exit from all this extraordinary lending and securities buying that the Fed has been doing over the last really 2 years. That is going to be the real trick here, to thread the needle, not to deprive the Fed of its support, and also to avoid inflation. And that's going to be the big trick.
So, Jesse, I can't help it. I'm a creature of Washington, and I'm seeing this sort of dichotomy of talking about a crisis at Jackson Hole. Do we know how much this retreat is costing when the same administration was spanking AIG and others for throwing these lavish retreats?
Well, you know, I'm naive, but I sort of feel like, despite the location, these Fed governors are not spending like Goldman Sachs bankers. So, you know, they go there and they just wonk it up. So I don't think that they're doing something anyway.
Well, there's a long tradition of central bankers getting together. I mean, I was reading about it during the Depression. It's the locations where they have like 12-course meals and supposedly fix the economy. I guess the question for me to you, though, Jesse, is Ben Bernanke may be fighting for his job in this speech. I mean, when you were writing for Portfolio, you had one of the best financial writing jobs, it seemed, in the business. Now you've found a new home at ProPublica. Any advice for Bernanke if he should lose his Fed chairmanship?
Well, he clearly loves the job. He's not going to lose it. He's going to be appointed because conventional wisdom has completely turned around for him. He came in with a very rocky start, and now he's really a figure of adulation among economists and policymakers, I think unfounded. I think that he's done quite a mixed job, mixed to poor job, but I think he's a shoo-in right now.
Right.
And he's gone on this massive PR campaign, which is very amusing. Fed chairmen are not used to that. Let me just
throw this at you really quickly. Less than a minute to go. What about the issue of the authority of the Fed versus the authority of the Treasury? Will we be seeing any signs in this speech of that turf battle between Geithner potentially and the Fed?
Well, we saw it last year, so I bet that there's going to be some defense of that this year, too. The Fed, under the Geithner plan, is supposed to get a big expanded regulatory authority, and that's one of the most controversial areas because in the lead-up to the credit crisis, the Fed was asleep at the switch as a regulator. So expanding their mandate is a highly questionable and controversial idea, and I don't think it's going to pass easily.
Right, and it'll probably be read between the lines there, plenty on that. Jesse Eisinger, the senior reporter at ProPublica, has it been a good year?
It's been a terrible year.
Terrible year.
For me, I got a new job.
There
Hopefully
we go.
Improving year.
Thanks so much. Tell us about your year of crisis. Reflect along with the Fed chairman at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. There's the theme. Time to say hello once again to Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor in the studio. And you got your good years in sports. You got your bad years in sports. As former Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick comes out of prison, New York Giants wide receiver Plaxico Burress sentenced to 2 years in prison yesterday after pleading guilty to a weapons charge.
This is a sad day because I think a very good man who is a brilliant athlete is going to unfortunately spend 20 months in prison when he had no intent to violate the law.
That was Burris's attorney, Benjamin Braffman, yesterday. Burris walked into a nightclub, you may remember, last November with a gun tucked in the waistband of his sweatpants. The gun slipped. He shot a bullet right into his leg, violating a major law in New York about carrying handguns. Ibrahim, this is a tough sentence and a tough road ahead for Plaxico Burress.
It certainly is. I compare him to Bernie Madoff, and I know we had talked about that before, but these are
harsh.
These are two people that achieved the pinnacle of their professional careers, and then because he caught the game-winning touchdown against the undefeated New England Patriots, and in less than 18 months later, he's going to prison.
Yeah, in the up and down, where I guess the chart would be the same as Madoff, but
exactly.
he didn't take as much from the rest
Without
of the world.
A doubt.
Although to Giants fans, and Jeff Blank is in the studios here is a Giants fan and also a lawyer, we wanted to get a fan view. I mean, he took a lot from the Giants last year by departing, Plaxico Burress did.
Yeah, John, last year he basically took away the psyche of the team. It became the Plaxico show as opposed to New York Giants football. The team had essentially revolved around him during the 2007 Super Bowl run. And this time around, it wasn't about football. It was about Plaxico. Every press conference that every player had to address the Plaxico show. So they basically brought that onto the field. It was Plaxico's not here.
Right. Well, I mean, what Jeff is describing there, Ibrahim, is really the issue that has plagued the NFL over the last few seasons, the lifestyle question of high-profile players and how much of a distraction it is to what happens on the field. How does this advance or change that story?
It's interesting. Chad Ochocinco, who's a wide receiver for the Bengals, he sent out a Twitter yesterday that said that this is a wake-up call to athletes that have to reconsider how they spend their free time. And he said, attention to all athletes, build a bunker at your home and stay there until your career is over.
Well, I have a little bit different question. How do these athletes get treated in prison when they go in?
Well, that's a good question. I think he's probably not going to get, intense time. He's going to get, more of the relaxed prison sentence. He's not going to go to
Madoff. He may be with Madoff. He may go to Madoff's prison.
Indeed.
There you go.
Do the inmates, challenge them athletically? Do they kind of put them on the spot? Stuff like that? I mean...
Who knows? I really hope that Plaxico takes a lot of time to think about what he did, and more about not what he did, but what the consequences of not thinking about his actions.
Well, Jeff, let me just ask you, and again, I don't know where you're going with the prison question there, Amy, but you're really starting to scare me. But Jeff, on the Giants, we really have it all, and I wonder if you agree. You've got Eli Manning, Mr. Golden Boy, versus the sort of dark kind of lifestyle questions of Plaxico Burress. Can the Giants put it together and show that the good wins out over evil?
The Giants can put it together because they've gone to training camp. They've put this behind them. I think the best thing that could have happened was that the indictment came in from the grand jury. Antonio Pierce was cleared, Antonio Pierce being the core of the Giants' defense, their leader. And at this point in time, while last year was a distraction, the Giants went into camp in Albany without Plaxico there. They start fresh. Now he's going to prison. There's nothing
right.
really there.
Well, Jeff Blank, a Giants fan and lawyer. I mean, even though we're talking about the Giants, this is not a New York centric issue. We could be talking about virtually any team in the NFL, right, Ibrahim?
This year we also had Dante Stallworth, who basically killed a man, and he spent 24 days in jail. And then you still have Terrell Owens, who his antics off the field get more attention than his antics on the field. So there is an issue about the lifestyles of NFL players and of how we treat athletes in the public sphere.
So, Jeff, as a lawyer, though, what do you say to this disparity? Plaxico's own defenders are saying, look, all he did was shoot himself in the foot. Vic, he terrorized and tortured animals and got less time.
I hear what people are saying. Unfortunately, Plaxico did this in New York City,
yeah.
where Mayor Bloomberg is on such an anti-gun crusade. He's been going to Washington. He's trying to get the laws revamped.
Should take his guns to dance clubs in Texas or something.
Right. I mean, if he'd done this anywhere else, I think it actually would have been downplayed, and it wouldn't have been as big of a deal.
All right. Let's take a look at the sort of light side, the positive side of sport, and what happened this morning in Berlin, Germany.
Away cleanly. Bolt has got a very good start indeed. Flies past Alonso Edward on the outside of him. Has had an excellent bench. Sean Crawford going well out in lane 8 as well. But it's all about Usain Bolt. 2 meters clear, 3 meters clear, 5 meters clear, and away he goes. He continues on his way towards another gold medal. Watch the clock this time. I can't believe it. A fantastic five. Five gold medals. Five world records.
Now, I clocked that at about 10 seconds there. That's Usain Bolt breaking his own world record in the 200-meter race at the World Championships in Berlin. This is just a huge monster story.
So last year, he won in the Olympics in Beijing, he won the 100, the 200, and the 4x1 in world record time. This year, he's poised to win the 100, the 200, and the 4x1 in world record time. No one has ever done that 2 years in a row. It's like winning the Grand Slam without losing a set for 2 years in a row.
And he says that he's capable of getting to 9.5 on the 200 meters.
I think he's capable. He said about the 100 where he ran a 9.58. He said he's capable.
In the 100, right.
Yeah, he said he could run a 9.4, but he said at a 9.4 that the world will stop at 9.4.
That's a dramatic statement. Ibrahim Abdelmateen, Takeaway Sports contributor here in the studio with Jeff Blank, a Giants fan and lawyer. Fastest man in the world at the Usain Bolt. And now, what other headlines are we watching this morning?
Well, this morning we've learned that the Justice Department is investigating whether military lawyers for Guantanamo Bay detainees illegally showed their clients pictures of CIA interrogators. Groups including the ACLU are working with the uniformed lawyers to defend detainees. The ACLU says the lawyers have done nothing wrong and calls the investigation misguided. Tom Ridge says he was pressured to raise the terror alert before the 2004 presidential election. The former Homeland Security chief says he didn't up the level despite pressure from then Defense Secretary
Secretary Don Rumsfeld and Attorney General John Ashcroft. A former Bush security advisor contests this. He says politics never played a role in setting alerts.
It's the last weekend to take advantage of the cash for clunkers rebate, so see if you can get the engine to turn over in that piece of garbage in your driveway, because the $3 billion program is almost out of money. Car buyers have until Monday night to make a deal. More news on the Blackwater CIA connection from our partner, the New York Times. Blackwater workers loaded missiles onto unmanned Predator aircraft. The drones are used to attack top Al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan and Afghanistan. This after another New York Times story this week that suggests that Blackwater was involved in assassination programs that were eventually discontinued by the CIA. A dozen are dead after an apparent U.S. drone attack in Pakistan today. The strike targeted a militant commander's compound. Quick look at some of today's top stories.
Up next, Afghan elections are over. We'll learn more.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes. I'm here with John Hockenberry. So, John, the news this morning out of Afghanistan is that both President Hamid Karzai and his competitor, Abdullah Abdullah, are claiming that they have majorities. But, of course, we know that that doesn't add up when it comes to the math. Joining us to discuss this from Kabul is Candace Rondeau, Senior Analyst for Afghanistan for the International Crisis Group. Candace, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So, Candace, set the scene for us today in Kabul. Is it quiet? How is the mood? How is it compared to yesterday?
Well, it's definitely a lot less tense than it was yesterday. There's more traffic on the streets. People are out doing their shopping, getting ready for, Friday prayers. So the scene is a lot more animated than we saw yesterday. The streets were virtually empty on election day. Everywhere we went, we saw maybe one, two people on the streets maximum. But the fear factor was very real and with good reason. On election day here in Kabul alone, I think there were something like 8 IED attacks, explosions, several reports of gunfights between rival candidates and their campaign staff. And then, of course, across the country, you had at least 75 to 135, incidents of violence, especially in your polling stations. So clearly the Taliban was delivering on its promise to disrupt the elections.
And what about those purple fingers? Do people still have them? Have they scrubbed them off out of fear for reprisals?
Right. Well, there have been some claims by some rival candidates, namely Ramzan Bashardost, who is the sort of one of the leading candidates for president here, or had been. And he sort of claimed that the ink can come off and so forth. And there have been some difficulties with the ink. I think it's simply a matter of, the election staff not being fully trained in knowing how to use it, just to shake it up and so forth. But it's not coming off my finger.
Okay, so the government is saying that they will not announce official results until September 3rd. Is there some fear or possibility that there will be violence between now and then?
Sure. I mean, in Afghanistan, there's always, fear that violence might disrupt normal life. And of course, the election and this rivalry between Abdullah Abdullah and President Hamid Karzai certainly enhances the chances of violent tension erupting, in part because what you have now are these two very experienced politicians coming out and exploiting this small window of uncertainty. That is to say, we don't know the results, and we really will not know the results for another 2 weeks. But each of them, of course, is claiming that they've won and that they are the victors. And this is something that, of course, only feeds into, I think, people's confusion over what's really going on and whether or not this process is real and valid.
So out of this, Candace, are Afghanis expecting a runoff?
There are some who believe there could be a runoff, and there are some who think that this could be a first run for Hamid Karzai. I'm certain the president himself is hopeful that it will be just a first run win for him. It is very difficult to say because, the factor here really is the low voter turnout. There have been claims from the IEC, which is the Independent Election Commission here, that they had something like 50% voter turnout. I did not see that here in Kabul. I really didn't. I would be surprised if we came even anywhere close to that. And in places like Kandahar and Helmand in the south, where the insurgency is so intense, I just can't see reaching a 50% turnout. I could be wrong, but I do think that the threat of violence was very real for people. And as to a runoff, if it does happen, I think the international community, the Afghan government, I hope that they're thinking ahead about what this will mean in terms of telling the possibility for violence, because there certainly will be a temptation on the part of the Taliban to exploit this window, which would be a month long. It would take about a month before you would set up for a runoff vote. And so that's a period in which nobody necessarily is empowered, so to speak. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity to say, you know, who's in charge here? And that's going to create problems as well.
Well, we'll be certainly following this story very closely, as we have done here at The Takeaway. Candace, I want to thank you for joining us from Kabul, Afghanistan. You were just listening to Candace Rondeau, Senior Analyst for Afghanistan at the International Crisis Group. John?
Well, I think the takeaway there is low voter turnout is a victory for, guess who, the Taliban. You can't
always get what you want. Asking for a loan here. You can't always
get what you want. Can I just get two more weeks? You can't always
get what you want. We just need to throw a lot of money at it.
A challenge in Afghanistan, getting what you want, but we want to talk about getting what you want out of your credit card company. This morning, a quick update now from Beth Koebliner, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. She's on the line from Los Angeles. Some new credit card regulations kick in this week. The main provisions won't take effect till next year, but what can people with the credit card bills that are worrisome look forward to this week, Beth?
Hi. Well, it's just two little baby steps right now. Number one, credit cards have to give you 45 days notice that they're going to increase your rates and fees.
And that's new.
Right. Before, it was only 15 days notice in most cases. And the second is credit cards have to mail out your statement 21 days before your due date. Previously, it would be more like 14 days or even fewer.
And that keeps you from having to be charged fees because you've got that lead time. You can plan. You can make sure you get paid on time.
Right. Hopefully, people will get their acts together. Now, the fact is 60% of people still are carrying a balance from month to month. So I think the big takeaway here is you want to make sure to pay off your credit cards as quickly as possible, get rid of the balances. Even though we're carrying less debt than we had previously, the average household still is carrying $7,900 in credit
wow.
card debt.
Finally, what about marketing to young people and other maybe credit risky individuals? Regulations
right.
affect
well,
that?
Well, exactly. Well, that provision doesn't kick in until February 22nd. So beginning, you know, in the middle of February, people under 21 won't be able to get a credit card without a parent co-signing or some sort of proof they have to pay the bill. What a concept, right? You have to actually show you can pay your bill in order to get a credit card.
Elementary financial concepts there. Good news for credit card holders as well. Beth Koebliner, author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And now, what's in the headlines this morning, Amy?
This morning, Hurricane Bill has lost a little strength, but Bermuda is still on alert. Major flooding is expected there. The Category 3 storm now has winds around 150 miles an hour. It's not expected to hit the U.S. directly, but could still bring strong waves and riptides to the East Coast.
Red ink in California has motivated some California lawmakers to block a plan to take thousands of inmates out of prison and put them under house arrest. The plan is part of a larger effort to save $1.2 billion on corrections spending, but some lawmakers aren't buying it. It has passed the Senate in the financially challenged state.
A high-level North Korean delegation paid respects today to the late former South Korean President Kim Dae-jung. This is the first visit to Seoul by North Korean officials in nearly 2 years. That's a look at some of today's top stories. Still ahead on The Takeaway, we're talking to Lawrence Bender, producer of the new film, Inglourious Basterds. He's a longtime collaborator of Quentin Tarantino's.
Yeah. I mean, it's the theme in the movie is revenge.
Not just any kind of revenge, being a hero.
But actual revenge.
We
is it good for the Jews?
Brutal,
is it good for the Jews in Hollywood? Turns out it's very good.
That's coming up in about 10 minutes. Stick with us, folks. This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And in these dog days of summer, the air conditioning is being cranked up at movie theaters all around the country. It's Friday, a good time to see some new movies. And joining us to talk about a few of the films that are out this week is our friend Wesley Morris, film critic for the Boston Globe. He joins us from our air-conditioned studios at the member station WGBH. Wesley, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, the air conditioning is on.
So it's very lovely.
Passing Strange was an implausible text for a Broadway musical, but was a huge success. It's now a movie, a Spike Lee film. How does it do?
It really works. I mean, Spike Lee brings out things in the show that didn't seem to be there before. And a lot of what it is just framing. Matthew Lee Batik is a cinematographer, and he basically takes this story of a young Los Angeles kid who decides to go on a quest to find himself. The term the movie uses is called the real. He needs to experience the not phony aspects of self-development. And it's a musical. The songs are great. He goes to Europe and discovers himself. I mean, a lot of it sounds pretentious in explaining it, but what it really calls out is a kind of truth about youth and self-discovery and finding how to express yourself artistically.
But it feels like, She's Gotta Have It. In many ways, Spike Lee's first big movie explored the inner life of a black, African-American teenager in America.
Well, this is a little different from She's Gotta Have It. I mean, that was this was about, this movie's about a guy who has a bunch of different sexual experiences, but it's radically different from many other Spike Lee projects. He's a very protean filmmaker in that way. I mean, nothing seems to turn him off or scare him. He can move from one disaster to a successful movie, and he just does what he wants to do. And I think this movie, you have to put up with some of the finger snapping and bohemianism of early 90s hip hop. But this show, basically, in the movie that Spike Lee is made of it, is kind of like a James Baldwin essay set to music. It's exhilarating. It's smart. It looks great. The songs are good.
But it's in limited release, and Spike Lee's last film, Miracle at Santa Ana, did not do very well. What kind of box office are you expecting for this?
I don't know. I'm really bad at predicting what people will want to see. I mean, this is a movie people should want to see, and it's an interesting time for a movie like this. It's about a character who happens to be black. I mean, I don't really like that phrase, but it's about his journey, his exploration of himself. It seems to be transcending in many ways the sort of racial issues that would limit it audience-wise. Miracle at St. Anna was not a good movie. It was not nearly as good as this.
Well, Spike Lee does his art house stuff, and then he does his blockbusters. This would seem to be in the art house realm. Passing Strange is the movie in limited release, as Amy points out. But let's get a comment from you on the other big movie that's out this week.
Members of the National Socialist Party conquered Europe through murder, torture, intimidation, and terror. And that's exactly what we're going to do to them. We will be cruel to the German.
The wacky Brad Pitt is now starring in Inglourious Bastard, the Lawrence Bender film, Quentin Tarantino film that's out this weekend. What do you think of the wacky Brad Pitt not playing it up as a leading man?
He's a good comedian. I mean, this is not perfect movie. There's so many things in this movie to like, including Brad Pitt.
So Pitt is the positive. Tarantino, maybe not so much. Wesley Morris, thanks so much. Reviewing movies for us and the Boston Globe film critic joined us from WGBH in Boston. Up ahead, more of Inglourious Bastards, which is with its producer, who is a glorious producer, right? He's an inglorious
man. He certainly made glorious piles of money.
He's the producer of Inglourious Bastards, and he's a longtime collaborator of Quentin Tarantino. It's going to be a great conversation. Stay tuned.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes, here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, Lawrence Bender, super producer behind Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, and the new Tarantino film, Inglourious Basterds, joins us from Nashville, Tennessee. But first, let's take a look at some of the top stories we're following. John?
Well, the Justice Department is investigating several military defense lawyers representing Guantanamo Bay detainees. The question is whether they illegally showed photos of their CIA interrogators to those clients.
In Afghanistan's presidential election, both frontrunners, incumbent Hamid Karzai and challenger Abdullah Abdullah, are claiming victory. Abdullah accuses Karzai supporters of vote rigging.
People were prevented from participating in some parts when those people were considered to be my sympathizers.
Other candidates are also making vote fraud accusations. Official results aren't expected until early September.
New Zealanders have overwhelmingly voted to let parents spank their kids. The vote overturns a law banning corporal punishment. The law was originally put in place to try to lower the country's high rate of child abuse. Question on the referendum in today's vote, quote, should a smack as part of a good parental correction be a criminal offense in New Zealand? Early tallies, 90% say no. Those are some of the top stories we're following today. Amy?
Coming up, Lawrence Bender, super producer behind Reservoir Dogs, joins us.
New film out today, Inglourious Basterds, one of the most anticipated films of the year. We just had a review of it from Wesley, but it opens today. Take a listen.
I'm putting together a special team. We're going to be doing one thing and one thing only, killing Nazis.
And somehow they managed to have fun doing that. You just heard Brad Pitt playing the lead Nazi hunter in Quentin Tarantino's highly anticipated new movie, Inglourious Basterds, out this weekend. The movie features a group of Jewish American soldiers known as the Bastards in Nazi-occupied France during World War II. It's sort of a revisionist film, I think we could say.
It's a fantasy,
and it's all about Nazi hunting, shooting them in the face. With us from Nashville, Tennessee, is longtime Quentin Tarantino collaborator and some might say co-conspirator, Hollywood producer Lawrence Bender. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Welcome to The Takeaway. So last night you just hosted a premiere in Nashville with the former vice president, Al Gore. You know, I'm picturing Al Gore, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, watching all this blood and gore. What was his reaction?
Well, he was gracious enough to host a movie for us. I produced An Inconvenient Truth, the movie about global warming with him. And, you know, one of our main characters, Brad Pitt, plays Aldo Raines in the movie, and he's from Tennessee. And, of course, Quentin Tarantino was born in Tennessee. So we couldn't open the movie today without having one screening down here. And it was fun. It was a lot of fun.
And the vice president liked it?
He loved it, yeah. He seemed to like it quite a bit. It was a lot of fun. It was a really fun screening.
So in this film, you get to kill Adolf Hitler. That's pretty wild. What was your first reaction to the script when you read it?
Well, I mean, come on. It's like a fantasy. It was really fun. I mean, at first I read it, I said, Quentin, as a fan, when I called them, I said, as a fan, I have to thank you. As your producing partner, I thank you. And also as a Jewish member of the tribe, I have to thank you.
That's funny. Well, let's get to that. Did this film speak to you as a Jewish kid from the Bronx in South Jersey?
You know, it was kind of funny because as a kid, I got pushed around quite a bit. You know, thrown into the locker. Nothing like earth-shattering, but I did get picked on quite a bit. So it does have a little bit of that kind of nice revenge, you know, as I watch it sometimes.
Although, Lawrence, you know, there's a deeper question, and we wouldn't want to compare your getting teased in Jersey and the Bronx with the deep Holocaust theme that is a really powerful theme in Hollywood films. And I'm wondering if you've got on the one side the theme of victimization, and you've got on the other side movies like, Spielberg movie Munich, which is all about mm-hmm. revenge. And I'm wondering, you know, where does that sort of theme stand? It's made some very, very powerful movies from Schindler's List to Munich. And where does this stand in that pantheon?
Well, this is definitely an empowerment type movie. You know, people, you know, there's some incredibly strong women characters, and they ultimately, you know, they are the ones who sort of take control and win at the end. Obviously, Brad Pitt playing Aldo Raines is this fantastic character who also takes matters into his own hands. But there's a wonderful theme in the movie. Actually, Al Gore and I were kind of joking about it last night, comparing An Inconvenient Truth and Inglourious Basterds, which is that cinema actually saves the world. And in this movie, literally and figuratively, there's a you can say that going to the movies actually ends up saving the world in this movie.
We're talking to Lawrence Bender, producer of Inglourious Basterds. It's out this weekend. So I have to ask you, what does your family think of this film?
Well, they're actually really proud of me, as, you know, most good parents are, their kids. But we screened it at the Jewish Museum in New York a few days ago when they were there, and it was quite wonderful, actually. It was a wonderful crowd, good questions, and Quentin did a great Q&A there. And, you know, as all parents are with their children, they were very proud of me.
Well, you know, there are different reviews, and I don't want to get into the reviews of this film, but I'm wondering, and your experience at the Jewish Museum in New York raises this question, if the success or failure of this movie says something about the moment in time past the Holocaust where it is permissible to have characters like these on a subject like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, first of all, this is a fantasy. It's imagination of Quentin's mind. It's not a true story. That's number one. Number two, I mean, you know, just to say, it's way beyond in terms of, you know, we're finding, because we're getting reviews from all over the world come in today, because, you know, it opens everywhere, not just nationwide, but worldwide. And we've gotten incredibly wonderful reviews out of Berlin, out of the UK, out of France. But what's great is I've never seen more wonderful reviews out of Germany. So it's being reviewed well everywhere, and it seems from what so far we're seeing is that it's not just guys, but also the women are loving the movie. So I think it's a movie that most people are going to enjoy.
So in the movie, you kick some serious Nazi butt, you know, faces get blown off.
Oh, that's
limbs
an evil
get,
laugh, Lawrence. That's a very evil
hacked
laugh.
Off. Eli Roth, one of the stars and director of another Blood and Guts movie called mm-hmm. Hostel, he calls the movie kosher porn. one of the questions that's been raised about this, Quentin Tarantino's not Jewish. Could a Jewish director have made this film?
Well, you know, the thing is, it's Quentin, pure, it's, you know, through and through, and it's you know, no, he's a auteur, so that's a very hard question to answer. I know this. I mean, you know, it's those great Quentin characters, those great dialogue, the great music that you're always used to seeing with Quentin's movies, that wonderful mixture of comedy with mixed with some violence. But it also has this maturity of it, this one, you know, the theme of World War II. He set off to write a Guys on a Mission movie, ended up kind of transforming the genre. So whether or not a Jewish person could have directed it, who knows? But you know, it's funny they say that in Germany too. It would take a non-German to write a movie like this.
Well, and it takes a Brad Pitt to basically have one foot in Exodus and the other in Pulp Fiction, because in many ways you get the wacky Brad Pitt that I haven't seen since. Well, you know, Burn Before Reading, but 12 Monkeys. You know, Brad was this kind of mm-hmm. nut character. Does he really? It must have been exciting. I'm actually surprised that Brad Pitt hasn't done a Tarantino film up to this point. Was it exciting to work with him?
Yeah, it was definitely exciting to work with Brad. He's a great guy. They've known each other, well, tangentially known each other for some time, and I think they've always probably wanted to work together. But when Quentin was writing the script last year, it became clear to him that Brad was the choice, and then as he kept on writing, it became, oh, Brad, the only choice. And then what if he's not available? What if he doesn't like it? You know, and that kind of thing. And so it was a little nerve-wracking getting him the script. But, of course, he dug it. And what's great about it was a lot of fun working with Brad. He was always in character. He was always playing Aldo Rain when he was walking around on the set. And so it was. He's first of all a phenomenal actor. He's always working with wonderful directors. Great guy to work with overall, and he was just a pleasure.
So, Lawrence, I have two really quick questions. Can you reveal the mystery of the misspellings of the movie's title? And do you think Tarantino has done a mitzvah here?
if only it were so, right? Yes, I think he's done a mitzvah for sure.
And the misspellings?
And if the box office is big, it'll be another mitzvah, too.
that's for sure. That's for sure. The misspellings is kind of like a creative flourish. And, you know, to sort of say what it is, I think kind of sort of dispels the flourish. So, you know, we don't really talk about that so much.
Any advice, Lawrence, on getting Brad Pitt to take our calls? You were able to encourage
okay.
him.
Do you have his home phone, maybe?
I'll give him a call and say, please take your call right now.
Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Fly safely back to Los Angeles. That was Lawrence Bender, producer of Inglourious Basterds and longtime Quentin Tarantino collaborator.
And Brad, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke is reflecting on a year in crisis. Think about it. Here's your takeaway.
Some dealers started to promote the program a month before the program officially started. And so when the doors opened at the Transportation Department to start processing the applications, they were already flooded with applications.
The answer to the auto industry crisis was cash for clunkers, but it's over. That's Micheline Maynard talking about the auto industry. If you missed anything, you can subscribe our podcast to go.
I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway. Have a great weekend. You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.